Good morning. My name is Victor Owens. My attorney registration number is 40353, and I'm here today on behalf of the defendant appellant, Mr. Walter Rogers. We are here today to discuss whether the district court erred in denying Mr. Walter Rogers' motion for post-conviction relief pursuant to Crimpy Rule 35C without granting an evidentiary hearing on the asserted claims and without appointing post-conviction counsel. Although there are many issues raised on my appeal, for my argument today, I'm hoping to focus on whether the district court erred in failing to grant an evidentiary hearing and whether the trial counsel provided ineffective assistance by failing to object to and request a mistrial when the prosecution introduced and elicited impermissible and prejudicial gang evidence. And two, whether the district court erred in failing to grant an evidentiary hearing on the issue of whether trial counsel provided ineffective assistance by failing to exercise peremptory challenges to challenge potentially biased jurors. And lastly, whether the district court erred in failing to appoint post-conviction counsel. First, I would like to address the third ineffective issue raised in my brief, which addresses counsel's failure to object at a request in mistrial when the prosecution elicited prejudicial information from a witness. Prior to trial, trial counsel filed a motion to suppress gang evidence and information. However, he later withdrew that motion with the intent of addressing that motion in limine. During trial, at the beginning, a motion in limine was held in which the district court limited the introduction of gang evidence, however stated that the doors were open. Doors could be open. However, despite the limitations of the introduction of gang evidence, the prosecution still elicited testimony concerning prejudicial gang evidence in an attempt to connect Mr. Rogers to the Crips street gang. Specifically, during the cross-examination of Jamel Thomas, the prosecution brought out information that during the booking procedure, Arapahoe County officers asked Mr. Thomas if he was affiliated with any gangs, in which he informed him that he was a member of the Crips street gang. Next, the prosecution brought out that Mr. Thomas, a non-Crips gang member, was later housed with Mr. Walter Rogers. Now, this in itself is prejudicial. The jury would surely make the connection that gang members are likely housed together in jail.
Pardon me, counsel, why would that be so? I mean, this is an urban area. You can have a lot of people in jail, and why is there an automatic inference that you're gonna have a gang member housed with another gang member? Doesn't that seem to be rather broad to you?
I think it is rather broad, but I do think that it's acceptable to put forth that the average person would believe that gang members would be held together, and specifically, gang members would not be held in, you know, a cell with an opposing gang member. And furthermore,
You're asking us to create a per se rule?
No. The prosecution actually continued on, and they asked Mr. Thomas what he had in common with Mr. Rogers, and they outright asked him whether or not he was a fellow member of the Crip Street Gang, despite the fact that the court had limited this introduction and the door was not open. Here, the defense did not open the door, and despite the fact that the gang information was supposed to be limited, the prosecution still brought the information in.
Wasn't the response that he didn't know?
Well, the prosecution first said, what do you have in common with Mr. Rogers? You have a lot of things in common with him, don't you? And then he went on to say, well, we have the same color skin, and we're both in the same, we both have been in the same neighborhoods and things of that nature. But just the fact that the prosecution brought up the words, the Crips, just the fact that the prosecution even said that is prejudicial. And in this case, requiring an evidentiary hearing to determine why trial counsel did not object and did not request a mistrial for this action.
Well, counsel, we're at some remove here. We're not in the courtroom. We don't see the jury. We have no idea inflection or tone. We have a cold record. And you're asking us to second guess a trial counsel who's sitting there who is in the battle, and who may make all sorts of very conscious decisions to do X or not to do X for reasons that we can't fathom because we're not there.
Actually, I'm not, Your Honor. I'm asking you to second guess the decision of the district court to deny an evidentiary hearing on Mr. Rogers' post-conviction claims. And this claim has merit. If there's more information that needs to be brought out and decided, that should be decided by the district court.
Well, but doesn't the fact, what don't the factors that I just raised suggest part of the answer to whether a hearing is necessary? Because once again, we have to defer, don't we, to trial counsel's ability to assess the situation and make some determinations. And unless and until we establish that this is a really bad thing that was really prejudicial and we've got a really good understanding of that, don't we have to defer?
Well, only if the decision was appropriate under the standard of care. And in this case, it was not appropriate. There was significant discussions about the introduction of gang information. The district court had already limited the introduction of it, and despite that, the prosecution brought it in. Defense counsel failed to object. There was a bench conference where they went back and forth, where the district court asked trial counsel, are you going to request a mistrial? And at that point, trial counsel should have requested a mistrial. He did not.
Well, wait. You say he should have.
Yes.
He may have thought the case was going his way at that point.
But objectively,
but we don't know, do we?
Objectively, the situation as far as whether, regardless of whether the case was going his way or not, the request for a mistrial and an objection to that issue was appropriate. Especially considering all of the gang discussion, the previous limiting instructions, and the fact that the prosecution brought it up multiple times. It was only after the fact, after that this information was brought in, that defense counsel got upset. And he said that to the court. He said, this makes me really upset. So clearly he didn't think that the case was going his way, at least on this particular issue. Now,
excuse me, Mr. Owens, even though the, let's just assume that it was deficient performance not to object to this evidence. In the context of ineffective assistance of counsel, doesn't the it can't just be prejudicial. It has to be so prejudicial that it would affect the outcome of the trial. And so could you explain how this evidence, as vague as it was, rises to that level?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, first of all, it affected the trial because it's the cumulative effect of all the multiple errors, because there was multiple errors that took place in this case. This, along with the fact that trial counsel failed to remove jurors that were potentially biased. And considering that he should have requested a mistrial. I'm sorry, could you
I'm just saying that the evidence really didn't come out very strongly, that there was some suggestion perhaps that he was a gang member, but no one ever really established it. And you're sort of saying that the juror should have drawn an inference from him being placed in the same cell as a gang member.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, this evidence seems so sort of vague that it's hard to understand how it would affect the outcome of the trial.
I guess what I'm saying is that the evidence of first prosecution saying you have things in common with him, don't you? And then he goes on to speak to the witness about his gang affiliation. And then he brings up the fact that the defendant was housed with this person that same day. And then in the next three sentences, he goes on to say, is Mr. Rogers a crip as well? And at that point, I mean, counsel should have objected for the first mention of the word crip, but he failed to do so. And those three instances in just this particular issue merit an evidentiary hearing, or at the bare minimum, it merits an evidentiary hearing as well as the appointment of post-conviction counsel, which Mr. Rogers was denied in this case.
I guess I'm still confused. Are you saying that the effect would have been, had he objected, they would have had a mistrial and had to start all over? Or if because the jury heard this evidence, arguably that the defendant was a gang member, that it caused them to be so overcome with prejudice that they found him guilty even though there was evidence that they otherwise wouldn't have?
I'm saying that it's reasonably probable that the jury would make an incorrect inference based upon the gang information, that because Mr. Rogers is housed with these gang members, that he has all these things in common with these gang members, and has been asked about being a gang member, or witness is asked about being a gang member, that they would take that leap, and that would affect their their impartiality in the situation.
So you're saying that by understanding that he was a gang member, that they would be more inclined to find him guilty instead of not guilty?
Yes, certainly, definitely. Colorado case law in this area is clear. Rules have been established to prevent the introduction of damaging and prejudicial information that is not relevant to the case. And this is especially true in gang information. One of the cases that I see directly on point is Arlington. In Arlington, Colorado addressed a similar issue where prosecution should not have solicited testimony from a witness who described the defendant to the police as being all crypt out. On the night of an incident, the witness described the defendant as being all crypt out. Although the court reversed on different grounds in that case, it did find that the prejudicial nature of just that remark, when measured by its probable effect upon the jury, is significant. So I believe that that error and that failure was ineffective assistance, and it merited an evidentiary hearing. Now, I'd like to move on to my second issue. The second issue I'd like to address is whether trial counsel provided ineffective assistance of counsel by failing to remove two biased jurors. Both jurors stated that they did not approve of drugs or people that do drugs, and one juror, Mrs. White, stated that she did not approve of people who sell drugs. Juror White stated that she absolutely did not approve of the drug lifestyle, and in response to the question of whether or not she could be fair when listening to people, whether or not there was lots of drugs involved or little, she stated, if you're talking about truckloads or ounces, I think there's a big difference. If you're talking about a normal parcel of drugs, I think if a man is guilty, a woman is guilty, then they're all guilty to the same extent. Now, that's a pretty significant and substantial feeling that she has about drug use and people that do drugs. It's also, Jerry never expressly stated that she could be fair. She just simply stated that the facts will tell whether a person is guilty or not. Now, this person said that someone who is convicted as possessing drugs should be convicted as selling drugs. And she just said, she didn't say whether or not she could be fair. She just simply said, the facts will tell me whether or not they're guilty. Next, another juror, Juror Canuck, informed trial counsel that her brother was a drug addict and that this is significantly affected her family. And as a result, she no longer has any contact with her brother. And she informed the court that he lost everything, his wife, his kids, his wife, his house. Now, Jerry Knapp did inform the court that she could be fair, but considering how deeply the subject affected her immediate family, it cannot be said with reasonable certainty that such experiences did not adversely affect her subconscious, preventing her from providing a fair and impartial opinion. Case law in this matter is clear. A criminal defendant has a right to a fair trial by impartial jurors. Here's two jurors that both expressed biases, and despite that, trial counsel failed to have them removed from the jury. They both sat on the jury. They both had a part in making the decision as to whether or not Mr. Rogers was innocent or guilty. Lastly, I'd like to address the fact that Mr. Rogers was denied the appointment of post-conviction counsel. This is critical. Post-conviction counsel should have been appointed. Reversal is appropriate in this instance. Mr. Rogers is serving a life sentence. He made every reasonable attempt to collaterally attack his conviction and obtain assistance by post-conviction counsel. In a case such as this, with a serious conviction, a serious sentence, and a large record, and expansive proceedings, the defendant's right to challenge his conviction is more important than ever.
Pardon me, counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you have any case that says that the right to counsel depends on whether a person is convicted of a more serious or a less serious crime?
No, Your Honor. But if a case is more serious and someone's serving a life sentence, I believe that their right to collaterally attack their conviction is all the more important, and that's why there should be some sort of overview, some sort of continuity within the process of appointing counsel.
Well, but doesn't the statute that the trial court has to follow focus on whether there is merit to the claim as opposed to whether the charges are serious or not serious?
The statute in case law in this matter states that the district court does not have to appoint counsel if the claims are totally unfounded. Now, in this situation,
So the answer to my question is yes, is that correct?
I see a distinction between what you said and the words of totally unfounded.
Well, that has to do with the merit of the claims, right?
Right. And then one is whether or not they are valid meritorious rising to the level of ineffectiveness just based upon the claim. And then another is totally unfounded, which has no merit at all. And
but again, that has the distinction is that has nothing to do with the seriousness or non-seriousness of the offenses of which he's convicted.
No, there's many defendants who will write, a one-page letter barely asserting claims, and yet they'll receive the appointment of post-conviction counsel. And in this case, that didn't happen. Mr. Rogers wrote a 22-page pro se motion. He put forth every conceivable claim that he could, and pro se motions are supposed to be construed liberally. And this in itself is an affront to justice because he deserves the right to have post-conviction counsel. He deserves the right to have someone help him with this procedure. It's a very complicated procedure, and there is no continuity within the appointment of counsel aspect. Furthermore, he raised the issue of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel in his post-conviction motion. And in Colorado, this court has found that you cannot raise claims of ineffective assistance of trial counsel on direct appeal. Therefore, his first time and chance of raising it was on a 35C, and the failure to provide him post-conviction counsel, therefore, is a violation of his Sixth Amendment right to counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Owens. Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court and counsel, Paul Kaler, 19210 for the people here. As this court knows, and opposing counsel knows, this is our first advisory notice case that's ever gone to argument. So I only have a few things I'd like to say, and I know it's a little bit unfair for Mr. Owens to hear my thoughts without having read them in brief. And if anything I'm saying is unfair, the court can is free to obviously free to tell me to hold my peace and sit back down. We have a good order in this case. It's very detailed. It found that some of the defendant's claims were not adequately, did not adequately set forth the facts and wanted to show. Also, a lot of the defendant's claims were not supported by the appellate record. As to the two claims we're talking about here today, obviously this was a gang, this was a drug deal turned into a drug robbery murder case. Everybody involved, by the nature of the claims, was unsympathetic. The gang evidence was, if that's what it was very minor. During a case with unsympathetic victims, it doesn't really matter there. As far as the peremptory challenge issue, I think almost all trial defense attorneys, trial prosecutors have numerous stories they can tell about during the jury selection process making counterintuitive choices in jurors. Sometimes they work out well and sometimes they don't.
But the point here, Mr. Kaler, is that there was...
Right, Your Honor.
So we don't have any kind of record that tells us what counsel was thinking or why they didn't object or why they pursued the route that they did.
Yes, sir.
And as I understand the defendant's main argument is, look, I filed a very detailed 35C motion. It alleged ineffective assistance of counsel, and even under Supreme Court precedent like Artolino, it's only when the trial court or the post-conviction court can decide that the record clearly refutes the assertions that you're not entitled to a hearing. Could you address that?
On this particular issue, jury selection issue, showing that a trial counsel was ineffective in its jury selection decisions, based on the cases I've read in the past, it's almost impossible to change because of the counterintuitive nature, because defense attorneys get to look at the jurors live, get to look at how they answer the questions. And here, this case too, as to both jurors, they said they had problems with drug issues, which is not uncommon for almost all jurors. And in this case, the victims were admitted drug dealers, and the defendant was involved with this too. If a juror who had problems with drug issues would be equally prejudiced against both parties. And in order to overcome this kind of strategic decision-making by counsel, defendant has to make a better showing than here, just more than just the fact that this person could have been objected to. There could have been a motion to excuse them for cause, but was not. And defendant hasn't made did not make a sufficient showing in his post-conviction motion to meet that high standard.
Mr. Kaler, on page 10 of the opening brief, I think the defendant argues that under this recent case, Martinez versus Ryan, that when a state doesn't allow a claim of ineffective assistance on direct appeal, that it basically promotes what is not Sixth Amendment counsel to raising the claim in a post-conviction proceeding to the status of direct appeal counsel. Could you address that argument?
I think that's a very interesting argument, and I think it was a good one to make. But still, the defendant has to plead facts which are not contrary to what the appellate record shows and which are adequate to meet the standard of demonstrating ineffective assistance of counsel.
Under the Sixth Amendment, they have basically an automatic right to direct appeal counsel, and so why wouldn't that hold true for this particular issue?
I have really no opinion on that.
In Colorado, are defendants prohibited from raising direct ineffective assistance of counsel on direct appeal?
Almost always. Occasionally, a claim comes through that can be made on direct appeal, but obviously this court has repeatedly said that it prefers the claims to be made in post-conviction review, where if they're well-pleaded claims, they can be fleshed out through an evidentiary hearing. But there's absolutely no reason to flesh out claims that are not well-pled.
Mr. Kaler, I want to ask you a question that Judge Boris asked counsel for the appellant. Going back to the issue of the gang information, she asked him about the prejudice of it. Could you talk to me about how the record refutes any allegation of prejudice?
Well, I don't have a great knowledge about the record, Your Honor, but based on prior briefing in this case, both of the eyewitnesses who survived this robbery, they had contact with the defendant on prior occasions. They knew him well, and they positively identified him as the shooter in this case. There's also talk about the car that was involved by the shooter in this case, and it was later found burning, and the defendant himself had burns on his leg, which tied him to the car. Also, when the defendant fled the state, and in the other state, he had made admissions to his father and a neighbor of his father that he had been involved in a shooting in Colorado. We argued on direct appeal as far as that issue, that was a very strong showing of guilt in this particular case. And I think it applies equally here. I have nothing further to say. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your arguments this morning. This case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.